Don't at me, but Afro-Asianism is the future, and it may just save our lives. Talking to Jeff Chang, author, provocateur, right after the theme song. Okay, look, so you are listening to Don't At Me. I'm your host, Justin Simeon, and this week I'm sitting down with writer and music critter Jeff Critter?
Critter? I could be a critter.
That's the most racist thing I've ever said. I think we should leave this in. Okay. Anyway, I'm sitting down with a writer and a music critic, Jeff Chang, and that doesn't even do you sort of justice, that description. I met you on a panel with Spike Lee.
Yeah.
I was familiar with your book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and I think you had just, I think you just put out Who We Be, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Let me see. We Gonna Be All Right is 2016. Yeah, Who We Be is what you had put out at the time. Mm-hmm. For those of you who don't know, Jeff has had an amazingly storied upbringing. He is a Hawaiian of Chinese descent. When he was in college at UC Berkeley, he was a student organizer in the anti-apartheid movement. What were you doing in college? That was going on at the time.
Were you even alive then?
He also had the nerve to run an independent hip-hop label in 1993 and has since written about hip-hop, its cultural implications on American society, and a number of really important things. Your most recent book, We Gonna Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation, is incredibly necessary, and it's also a quick read on everything that's going on in America right now. What's up, Jeff?
What's up, Justin?
Let's start with the easy questions.
Okay, please.
What the hell are we going to do? Like, what are we going to do?
What are we
going to
do?
I'm terrified, Jeff, of the state of race relations in America. Just break down the solutions just really quick. Let's get that off the list.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, just tell me physically what to do.
My top five plans to solve racism.
Yeah, just like, who do I vote for? Where do I... Just tell me what's the plan? What are we doing? How do we get out of this?
Wow. I think you're doing everything you can, man. Like, with all the work that you're doing. I just think we got to change the culture.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like the culture now is one of division. It's one of polarization. It's one of adding folks, you know?
Yeah.
And
adding folks. Yeah, absolutely. You
know? And it's a kind of thing where, you know, it's weird. When I was young and angry, I'm not even post young anymore. I was young and angry, then post young and angry. Now I'm old and angry.
Shut up, Jeff.
but
don't look a day over 23.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, we were it well.
They
yeah?
say black don't crack, but neither whatever proper term for Asians are. Don't at me. I can't say yellow. But how would you refer?
It's funny.
Asian
We've had a
Chinese
debate about that.
Or?
We've had. I'm actually Chinese and a native Hawaiian.
Ah, okay.
So, okay. And it's an interesting thing because when you say Hawaiian, right, mm-hmm. people assume it's because you're from the islands, but yeah. Hawaiian is, you know, an ethnicity.
Right.
And so right. folks of Hawaiian descent are always like, you know, that's not really the right terminology
I
for
see.
That.
So we'll re-record that part. It's fine.
No, you don't have to. Happy to be a music critter, cultural critter.
Well, whatever blend of
Hawaiian,
ethnicities you are, they don't crack.
Chinese. We don't. And I mean, you know, my folks have been around and mm-hmm. they look like they're in their 50s.
I know, man.
It's just
crazy.
I'm sure your folks are like that too.
Oh, yeah.
It's a beautiful thing.
It's nuts.
Yeah.
It's weird. I'm excited about aging.
I
should really love what you said about culture. It's why I call my production company Culture Machine. I think culture is the stories that we tell ourselves. Right. And that's what I think distinguishes us from mm-hmm. the rest of the planet, is that we have the ability to tell ourselves stories and create a world,
yes.
you know, that doesn't exist in nature, but exists in our minds. I'm going to read a quote that really sticks out for me that you said, and I want you to talk about a little bit. Mm-hmm. So you said, culture, like food, is necessary to sustain us. It molds us and shapes our relations to each other. An inequitable culture is one in which people do not have the same power to create, access, or circulate their practices, works, ideas, and stories. It is one in which people cannot represent themselves equally. To say that American culture is inequitable is to say that it moves us away from seeing each other in our full humanity. Talk to me about that. Unpack
right.
that for me.
Because well, I mean,
that's like my
back,
philosophy in life. So.
Yeah, and it goes back to your first question, I think. You know, if we create the seeds of a culture that brings people together, that mm-hmm. allows folks to be able to see each other in their full humanity, then we've got a chance to basically survive. I mean, God knows we've got huge issues on this planet. And I tell my kids, I tell my students, you know, the two biggest issues they're going to confront during their times is climate change, mm-hmm. which is the ultimate issue, right? Yes. It involves us all. And of course, before that, if we are all going to be minorities, like how do we form a new majority?
Right.
And what is that majority going to point towards? And so at this particular point, yeah, I feel like you, you know, I feel I'm angry, but I'm trying hard to figure out how to transmute that anger into something that is more positive. And I don't mean like just basically falling down and like allowing people to kick me in the head or that kind of thing, right? Yeah. It's not this turn the other cheek type of thing. It's the stand up and fight type of thing of we've got to fight for all of us.
Right.
We can't allow people to be, you know, figuring out how to pigeonhole us and divide us and continue to point us in a direction of death, mm-hmm. really. We're living in a death culture.
I mean, I think what's so interesting about what you're saying is that, you know, when people hear people like me or actors or whatever talking about representation, mm-hmm. and I was having a conversation with someone the other day about, like, you know, in totally as a joke, just saying, you know, oh, yeah, you know, being white is, like, the worst thing in America right now. It's like, no, that's not it. You know, it's this feeling that, like, yeah. we're just whining about representation yeah. or that we are just, like, we somehow have an advantage because we're other. But what you're saying is that the reason, and I agree with you, the reason why representation is so important is because it shapes the culture.
That's right.
And the culture shapes us.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, what do you think? Like, is it culture? Is it politics? Is it both? Like, what's really going to bring us to this next place?
I mean, it's all of the above, but I feel like the culture is the piece that moves the politics, right? Mm. The culture is the thing that sort of surrounds the politics. It's the thing that drives us to vote. It's the thing that drives us not to vote. Like, my entire generation, folks didn't want to vote.
Yeah.
And for good reasons. It's because you looked at government and you said to yourself, why would I vote? Like, these folks are just going to figure out other ways to incarcerate us. And they did.
Right.
And they still are, right? And then we said to ourselves at some point, we got older and we said, we've got to figure out a way to make our power known. And so people began organizing. And, mm-hmm. and it came from a cultural kind of point of view, this idea of, like, if we're going to improve ourselves, right, then we've got to go and take the reins of power. But we came up with hip hop as a way to give us a vision mm-hmm. of seeing how things could be. And it's not to say that hip hop is perfect. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all kinds of problems with it. But at least it gave us a way to be able to figure out how to be together.
Right. Right?
We could have discussions. We could have arguments, right? We could get transformed through this beautiful thing that is, it's the latest development in this Black freedom culture that has given us all hope, you
right.
know, generations upon generations of folks in this country and around the world hope for so many years. So hip hop was our thing. And we said, okay, we've got to go out and vote now. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at 2002, 2003, 2004.
Because it's a voice of some kind.
It was a voice of some kind.
Yeah.
So people would, you know, organize against a prison. They go to the board that was deciding, the city council or the supervisors, and they would take the mic. They would literally take the mic, and they wouldn't necessarily be, like, you're supposed to go there in this chamber and make an appeal to mm-hmm. these people in power. And they would take the mic and they'd turn it around and they'd get the crowd hyped.
Yeah.
Because all of these people were there to say, no, we're against this prison. And the leaders there would have to say, okay, you know, we're looking at the future here. We're looking
right.
at folks who are actually going to get themselves organized to vote. And they would vote the prisons down. And then we would continue that on and on and on all the way up the ladder until,
right.
you know, we caught hope literally in the form of Obama. And that's a whole other story.
Well, listen, we might get into it today. I have a feeling okay. we could talk about a lot of things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I, for people who don't know, I mean, I think some people think of hip hop and they sort of think about Cardi B or they think about Nicki Minaj, and these are great artists. But yeah. Hip hop really began, listen, I mean, the first, I guess, single, Rapper's Delight, praise be to Sylvia Robinson, who really was the first person who made it, you know, a marketplace, really. But before that, it was a bunch of Black and brown and folks who weren't white, and some white folks too.
And some white folks.
Getting together.
Not many.
Yeah.
Not many.
Yeah. But people who didn't feel like they had a voice anywhere else, getting together in New York and other places around the country and sort of like speaking over disco records.
Yep.
And it became this like way for a people who didn't have any other outlet in culture to say something. And that something caught on with white folks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I like right now I'm doing a movie called Bad Hair. Mm-hmm. It takes place in 1989 during the New Jack Swing era. And the reason I think it's so important is because those are like, it's like a Trojan horse to get some of these black conversations into mainstream America. I mean, yeah. Music has sort of traditionally been our way in.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I kind of want to talk about how you, I mean, because, you know, listen, you're an Asian American mm-hmm. who, frankly, I think knows more about black culture than like a lot of folks walking around. And there's a connection between those communities that I don't think is obvious to the average person. And so I'm curious, like, how did you get involved in hip hop specifically? And, you know, what is the connection, you know, between these cultures that honestly a lot of people don't get?
Yeah. Whew, that's a big one.
I know,
man.
We can break it down. Let's start with hip hop.
I mean, if you think about American popular culture, it really was founded on two narratives. One was the genocide of Indians, right? The cowboys mm-hmm. and Indians, the Western. And the other was blackface minstrelsy,
yep.
which was justifying slavery.
And was the biggest form of American entertainment.
Absolutely.
Really ever.
Really ever. I mean, this is like where America is like, oh, now we're a country because we're united in our derogation of black people.
And people don't get that.
Yeah.
You know, if these things were available and you could go back and see the first films, mm-hmm. the first silent feature films, the vast majority of those are blackface because that was so popular at the
right.
time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you get black directors who are moving into film, right? Oscar Michaud and all these mm-hmm. other folks who are trying to basically tell stories.
And Oscar Michaud is probably, the first black feature filmmaker
probably,
that we
yeah.
know in history, really?
Okay. Yeah. DJ Spooky did a beautiful, amazing box set of all these early silent films, mm-hmm. African-American silent films. But it was amazing. It's a mind-blowing set, right? Because you think about the history of film and the birth, D.W. Griffith's The Birth of a Nation, really reinstalling the KKK at a moment where it's at its low, its ebb.
Absolutely.
And then these
Which
artists.
Which I can't relate to at all.
No, not at all.
All by the way, over the fear of black people in government,
Absolutely.
I would like to also point out.
Yes.
Did the KKK get a.
Scenes, right?
A breath of fresh air
exactly.
in the 20s.
And I mean, scenes of these entire like Senate chambers and stuff like that, of all these white men in blackface eating chicken and mm-hmm. stuff like that, right? It's just, it's horrible. This is like hailed as the birth of American film.
Mm hmm.
And you have all these directors coming in and saying, we're going to flip that.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, music always being the place where there was that most fluidity.
Mm-hmm.
And so moving from race records to desegregating the charts for a hot second mm-hmm. before they get resegregated again, which again is a sort of cycle in popular music.
Because people don't realize there used to be a thing called the black charts.
The black charts.
Like it wasn't called yes. R&B.
All the way up till like, like 5 or 10 years ago or
yeah,
something?
Yeah, you would flip through Billboard yeah. and it'd be like, black songs.
Yes.
I mean, that really was how
yeah.
it was sort of figured out in America. That's why, you know, Michael Jackson was such a big deal and Whitney Houston was such a big deal because they were the only ones before New Jack.
Yeah.
That got played on what were traditionally rock stations, which we would now call pop stations.
That's right. Yep.
Okay. So.
So yeah, Michael Jackson and Prince breaking it down, and mm-hmm. and then Run DMC, and then hip hop coming in, kind of as a way of representing this really new diverse generation and stuff.
So how do you find yourself in the middle of this of hip hop culture?
So I'm growing up like any other kid, you know, in the 70s and the 80s. In Hawaii, it was interesting because the popular music then in the islands was sort of Hawaiian folk music that was about land protest.
Hmm.
And or if it wasn't necessarily explicitly about land protests, it was about like what a lot of Hawaiian music has been about. You know, it's the beauty of the land, the meaning of place, you mm-hmm. know, celebration of local culture. And so that was kind of my eldest cousins. I come from like a big extended family. So my eldest cousins were into that. And then by the time I'm coming of age, there's all of this development, a lot of money pouring in from Japan, from continental US, and all of these buildings going up all around Honolulu, Waikiki especially. And I just, one day, I think I saw Beat Street or whatever it was. It was Breakin'. I think we saw, probably saw Breakin' first.
These are feature films for, you know, our listeners who don't know. Hip-hop feature films.
Yeah, the hip-hop exploitation movies.
That's like, right.
Breakin' was like Sweet Sweetback for hip-hop.
It's true.
But, you know, like looking at that, seeing these like kids of color who just had all kinds of swag.
Yeah.
And they had a whole way of defining themselves. And they were doing it visually with graffiti, and they're doing it musically, and they're doing it on the dance floor. They're doing it all kinds of ways. And that was just really powerful to me. Mm. And I realize now, like, I got into graffiti because I was kind of an artist nerd, and I thought I could be pretty good at it. And I just hated concrete. There's so much concrete going up, man. It was like, wow, they really urbanized, you know,
everything is my white city. Clean walls.
Yeah,
everywhere.
White clean walls everywhere. I just wanted to tag it, you know? And so that was like the sort of entry level kind of thing. And then you kind of like find out that there's a whole thing to this. There's a whole history to it.
Sure.
You know? I read like every article I could get, you know, in the national press, and I was buying every book that I could get, trying to be down, you know, trying very hard, you know, as a kid, like a whole bunch of other kids. I wasn't alone.
Right.
You know, there was like tens of thousands of kids my age who were doing the same thing in Honolulu at the same time. And then I moved to California and was dropped. I went to Berkeley and I was right in the middle of this like amazing East Bay scene, like on Telegraph. This was like the height of the cruising era, you know. So just like over here in Westwood or on Whittier Boulevard or on Crenshaw, people would go and hang out and cruise on weekends. Like Telegraph Avenue and Duran Avenue was the place for folks to kind of meet up on weekends.
Right.
And you would just see like popping ciphers, breaking ciphers, rap ciphers everywhere. And I was there for about a year before there was a bunch of fights that broke out in which a lot of frat boys from the Hill got beaten up.
Huh.
And of course they would frame it as race riots.
Right.
And you know, the
beaten
whole thing.
Because
and,
they would come they to were these acting neighborhoods.
Or, I mean, they would literally come down and harass folks of color. I mean, I was one of those kids who would be like standing on the corner on a Saturday night and like a mob of frat boys, white frat boys coming down the hill, and me and my Chinese American friend, right?
Yeah.
Like just getting roughed up and pushed around and harassed and called names and stuff like that, you know? Wow. And I'm like, wow, like we don't have this in Hawaii. This is new.
How did black folks treat you when you came to California and sort of, you know, found yourself in hip hop culture? Like how did that go down?
I mean, it was cool. We lived, you know, in the same, actually on the same street that I live on now.
Yeah.
So it was in South Berkeley. Cause you know, the thing about Cal is like, there's no, this probably changed a little bit, but there was no housing.
Mm.
So I was in the dorms the first year. And the second year, you know, we'd have to go and find a place to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so we found a place that I actually found out much later was where Johnny Otis grew up. Johnny Otis is like this famous white blues man from Berkeley.
Wow.
His son was Shuggie Otis, who's like this legend in hip hop amongst DJs because he made these two albums that were like psychedelic funk that
were
really
albums?
Popular. Shuggie Otis. What was it called? Inspiration Information, I think was the album.
Inspiration Information. This is KCRW, so they might, you know, can incorporate a song or something.
No, I'm sure they play it on a lot of the shows and stuff. But it was a historically black neighborhood. In fact, the first cartoonist, the first syndicated black cartoonist, nationally syndicated black cartoonist lived on that block, this guy named Maury Turner, who later I became really good friends with and became sort of a mentor to me. But every weekend on Sundays, you would hear on all the stoops, people would be playing this hip hop show, this guy named Natty Prep. And I hung out at the radio station. So he was kind of like a legend to me. You know, the kids would be knocking on the door and we'd go and hang out. We'd drive them around on our bikes and that kind of thing. And it was the sound of the neighborhood was this hip hop show. So, I mean, I never, you know, people always ask me the question as if to assume, not you, but I'm saying some people ask the question as if to assume, oh, you must have like, it must have been really, you know, difficult. Hard, you must have been harassed or something like that. You know, like, what are you doing here? You cultural appropriator or whatever. But I feel like that's the language of now, you know? I went in like anybody else. Like, I was a fan of the music and, I was a fan of the music and I was, you know, I was respectful. And, you know, I like to say, like, in hip hop, you have to show and prove in the cipher. And then people will either give you respect or you just hang back in the crowd in the circle.
I mean, what I think is so interesting is you like found kind of an American home in this thing that, you know, came out of Black culture, which is so interesting to me because in people's minds, they're separate. You know, like you said, I think the reason why people assume that is because we're taught and conditioned to think that these sort of marginalized communities actually don't really have anything to do with each other. It actually, in We Gonna Be Alright, you talk about a story of, you're specifically at a protest about Black and Latino folks. Mm-hmm. And an Asian American sort of comes up to you and is frustrated with you because they feel that you working on behalf of these people is somehow taking something away from this other group of people.
From Chinese Americans, yeah.
So, like, why is there this divide in our minds?
I mean, it goes back to the way that, you know, Blackness is seen. And for me, learning about the history of Black freedom movements and then being deeply engaged through the radio station, the college radio station, KALX, with Black freedom music and understanding the traditions from like South Africa through reggae in the Caribbean, you know, which I grew up with in Hawaii too. And then of course hip hop and connecting these things together, it gave me a way of being able to voice how I felt I was being treated as somebody of, you know, yellow brown skin, right?
Sure.
And so for me, you know, the sort of cultural the cultural education and the political education went hand in hand.
Yes.
For me, it did. And so, you know, the issue that was happening at the university at the time, which all of this stuff repeats itself, was that the university, that UC Berkeley was discriminating against Asian Americans in the admissions process.
Sure.
And the thing that we always said was, we're not against affirmative action. Mm-hmm. We're against, like, the fact that Asians are being treated like less than whites in this like supposedly open, fair meritocratic system. Mm-hmm. And so now there's a lawsuit at Harvard, for instance, around this kind of thing.
Because there's like a personality score or something, right?
And against none Asians. Of us have any kind of personality, of course. We know that. We know that to be true.
And all Black people have is personality.
Exactly. And Latinos, right?
Yeah, like, we don't have like smarts or knowledge.
The way I describe it is like, it's weird because we can't be as white as the whites and we're less colorful than Blacks and Latinos in this particular process. This is a really bizarre type of thing.
Well, I was going to say, it feels like, you know, American society, the society sort of decided where each of us go.
Right.
You know, it's like Black people can do entertainment and sports. You know what I mean? Like Asians, y'all can do math. You know, Indians, y'all can do technology. It's just sort of like Mexicans, you can be laborers. It's sort of, this was just decided.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how we all kind of go along with it to a certain degree. Like, we don't even really, we're not thinking about, you know, that we're actually in the same boat.
Yeah.
You know
absolutely.
What I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like it's
and the boat is leaking.
Yeah.
It's going down.
It's going down. I feel like the, you know, I keep thinking about the conspiracy that I don't really think is a theory, but the idea that really when MLK, when it was time, when, you know, when people got tired of him, was really when he was trying to unite poor folks. Mm-hmm. Because I think, you know, I feel like the accomplishment, the reason why a minority of white, straight, conservative men have so much control in this country is because there have been all of these efforts to make us all think that we're separate. You know, you have working class white people feeling as if something is being taken away from them if they help Black people reach equality. And you have Black people feeling resentful of Korean Americans in their communities who, you know, maybe have been set up to have some kind of business ownership in different ways, but they're also in a very thin lane. You know what I mean? Is it a conspiracy, Jeff? Or did this?
I don't think it's a conspiracy. the funny thing is like, you know, we always used to talk about, because hip hop's full of conspiracy theories, right? Mm-hmm, it's always been full of conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And I always used to think, well, there's no reason to have conspiracy theories because this stuff is all right out in the open,
it's
right?
Already it's so like, messed up.
It's all right in front of you. You don't actually have to look for some grand conspiracy.
Yeah.
You know, the stuff is right there. And it's like, yeah, I mean, we're all indexed to a form of whiteness that everybody else is less than.
Yeah.
You know, so going back to this incident where I'm arguing with, you know, another Chinese American woman, right?
Yeah.
Who I'm looking at her face. She's been around the block. She's probably like grown up during a time where she couldn't live anywhere else but Chinatown.
Yes.
You know what I mean? She's got kids and grandkids that she wants to be able to go to the best schools like anybody else does. And I'm arguing here for affirmative action, for desegregation orders, you know, to be able to allow Black and Latino folks into the one magnet school in San Francisco, or not the only magnet school, but the one major magnet school in San Francisco, where like Asians now make up not just a plurality, not just a majority, but the overwhelming amount of students who are in this public school. Mm-hmm. And she's like, we should be getting rid of affirmative action because it's discriminating against Chinese Americans. And I'm like, how many like seats should we be taking here?
Right.
You know? And she's looking at me like, discrimination is discrimination, isn't it? I just want to fight against discrimination against Chinese Americans. And at some point, I'm like sitting there with that exasperated sigh going, wow, you know what I mean? This is the way that we've been taught to fight against each other.
What's mine?
What's mine?
Yeah.
What do I claim, right?
Yeah.
And so we've learned from the civil rights movement that the way that we do it is to legally go and try to remove these so-called, you know, barriers. But we're not thinking about the big picture. Like, why is it that there's this one school that's a public school that everybody's trying to get into?
Mm-hmm.
Why are we not trying to approve all the schools?
Yeah.
Right? And why is it that we're all trying to get into, you know, these elite universities? I'm a product of elite universities, yeah. But I also can't go through this process and still believe in meritocracy.
Yes.
They just change the rules.
They change the rules.
However they want to.
Yeah.
Right? And that's not the point. The point is why is education not more available, more accessible, more affordable for everyone?
Let me tell you when they fucked up, okay?
You got a moment? You got a year?
I want to tell you where they all fucked up.
Okay.
But first, we're going to take a little bit of a break. I'll be right back with Jeff Chang on Don't At Me, Y'all. It's a big one.
Thank you for listening to this KCRW podcast. In case you don't know us, KCRW is public radio in Los Angeles, bringing the best of NPR to Southern California. We're also known for our own brand of bold and innovative programming, evocative storytelling, taste-making music, and audio documentaries that are little movies for your ears. You can join our community to support this show and others, or make a one-time donation just to say thank you. Find out more at kcrw.com/join.
Whew, that was a good break. Had some punch and some cookies up in here. None of that happened. all right, I'm back with Jeff Chang. Here's where they fucked up.
Okay? Where did they fuck up?
They fucked up by pretending that America was a meritocracy and telling white men from the 1800s onward that it's a meritocracy. That's where they fucked up, because we all grew up believing that shit. And when we become adults and we encounter systemic racism, institutionalized racism, we realize America is not a meritocracy. We're pissed and we're fired up and we want it to be. And the white folks that grew up thinking that all of this was because of their hard work, when they start to be confronted with the idea that maybe they had some privilege or some advantage, their belief in the meritocracy sort of crumbles.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the one sliver of hope that I have, is that like we all have this idea of freedom in our heads, that this should be a place where your hard work and your chutzpah and your stick-to-itness actually pays off in equal measure. I don't know how we get there. You know, I'm a gay black man, and to me, one of the great tragedies is that you have gay folks who couldn't fight for their own rights in the civil rights movement, Bayard Rustin perhaps being chief among them, who is a gay black man who was just out here with white boys and just doing his thing. Mm-hmm. But he was the man behind Martin Luther King. He was the man helping plan a lot of those major cultural moments, but he stayed out of the limelight because people weren't ready for all of that. That's up right. in the 60s. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying black people achieved civil rights. I think the Vietnam situation happened and a bunch of assassinations happened and we kind of got distracted, but we achieved some things in the 60s. And when it came time for gay folks, particularly in the late 70s, early 80s, during ACT UP and, you know, the AIDS movements and all that stuff, black people weren't there to return the favor, you know? Black people, I don't think, in general, were even educated about the connection between the communities. Mm. And here we are again in this present day where all of these different groups are affected by this thing, this indexing against whiteness and maleness. We can't seem to work together again. Mm-hmm. And the truth is we are the majority, if we could figure mm-hmm. that, if we could wrap our heads mm-hmm. around that. So. Yeah. I feel like you are at the nexus of so many cultural things. Do you have any thoughts about how the rest of us get there?
I mean, I'm struggling just like everybody else is.
Yeah.
But, you know, I try to take some hope from elders like Grace Lee Boggs. You know, Grace Lee Boggs was this amazing organizer from Detroit, Chinese American woman who, you know, came up and decided to root herself in Detroit. And to root yourself in Detroit, of course, meant during this particular period of white flight, rooting yourself in the black community, mm-hmm. rooting yourself amongst laborers, folks who were working in the auto plants, rooting yourself amongst folks who were trying to find sort of a radical way to live and be. And the thing that she, you know, always says is that we've got to be able to have the imagination to be able to move to where we need to go. Mm. We have to be able to think about what hasn't come yet. And I think that that's the biggest kind of thing that we have to overcome. What's interesting to me is that the folks who want to preserve the status quo, they always talk about going back, right? Mm-hmm. Like, make America great again. Like, mm-hmm. let's go and restore America to—
Who's saying? I haven't heard that phrase before. Who's saying that?
I don't know.
Okay. Just something a big somewhere.
Yeah. A baby.
Must be some small community. Okay. Mm-hmm.
They want to go back.
Yeah.
You know, they want to go back to a time where the index was even more stark.
Right.
And for the rest of us, it never really was. And so, like, the difficulty is that we've got to be able to find a way to think about this kind of stuff in new ways. And that's why I think, you know, I'm so deeply engaged in culture. One was because I was like not very good at organizing. Uh-huh. I just was a failed community organizer. It was, you know, easier for me to talk to people and yeah. get their stories and, you know, connect the story together and pull it all together. I was always better at storytelling than
same,
I was.
No, that's same. That's my contribution. It's yeah. like I'll never be a politician.
Right.
You know, I hardly remember to like text people back, let alone organize, you know, but I can tell these stories, you know.
So and it's super it's important powerful. Because, you know, it's like you were saying at the beginning, it's sort of, it's these new stories that engage all of us, mm-hmm. you know, that we have to be able to tell.
Yeah.
You know, you have to take on really difficult questions
yeah.
in order to kind of get at truths.
Yeah.
And you kind of have to expose a lot of stuff. Expose a lot of shit.
Expose a lot of stuff that people aren't necessarily interested in being exposed to sometimes.
Or ready for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
You know, I mean, just the reaction to the title, Dear White People, which really inspired Don't At Me.
Right.
You know, if I was a white guy who wrote something called Dear White People, there would be no animus. And I know this because the same year I started tweeting from the account, there was shit white people like, or, you know, stuff white people like, excuse me, and the YouTube series Shit White People Say and all that kind of stuff. And it was authored by white people. And so it was ironic. It was tongue-in-cheek and it was fun. And but the minute, you know, you hear the words white people come out of a black person's mouth, suddenly we're afraid of some kind of overthrow or something.
Okay. It brings up all of these fears. I mean, which are all irrational. And so, you know, if you put it on the table and you expose it in the way that you've been doing or in the way that other people have been doing in their stories and that kind of thing, then hopefully it gives us a way to be able to understand, like, you know, to see that mirror and be like, ooh, I don't want to look like that.
Right.
You know?
Well, what I think is so, again, powerful about what you're doing is not only are you breaking down, I think, aspects of Black culture throughout your books that are so important and I think really accessible, the way you write is so accessible, but I think you're helping people bridge the gap. Like, if you start with slavery and you start with Black folks and brown folks, you do get to classism, you do get to feminine, you get to the other things. But why is that the starting point for you? Like, how does that help the rest of us?
For me, for instance, the movement for Black Lives put together an agenda. And if you look at that agenda, right, it's keyed towards Black people. But if you really implement this agenda, it's going to help everybody. Economic justice, ending incarceration, education for all, healthcare, you know, for all. Like, this is going to help everybody. And the Women's March picked up on that kind of thing, right? They said, you know, we can't just be about these narrow types of things, like fighting over, is this a woman's issue? Is this not a woman's issue? Everything's a woman's issue. And so they picked up on that from the Movement for Black Lives, and they created intersectional agendas, right? And so folks are figuring out, like, how to work together in real time right now. That's exciting. You know, that's the kind of thing that actually makes me feel pretty good. That's the kind of stuff that we thought we might be getting at in 2008 and 2009. And it took us years.
Because we got comfortable.
We did get comfortable, I think.
And we thought we arrived.
We thought we arrived, and I think we also had a little bit of irrational exuberance about, like, you know, we wanted a Messiah to lead us, and we've been, you know, we've been told and we've learned time and time again that a Messiah is not going to appear, least of all somebody within this corrupted political process. So, well, I think there's so many other things to say about that. But,
well, you know, when people get into criticizing Barack, and listen, I mean, he has things that should be criticized. I think every American president should be criticized, no matter who they are. But I do think that there's this, I think it's a form of systemic oppression to sort of assume that the exceptional, talented model minority, it's a riff off of the magical Negro. It's like they can do anything. I mean, it's a thing, in my opinion, that killed Michael and killed Whitney and all these people, is because everyone is hanging the entirety of their racist hope on this one person. And because they were so exceptional that they emerged from this crazy, you know, culture, we expect that they can do anything. And isn't that a form? I feel like that's a form of oppression.
That is, in a way.
Yeah.
Does this apply to Kanye as well?
No. I never put the hopes of my race on Kanye West, so that's one.
I hear you.
You know, everyone has a right to say what they want to say. I'm more annoyed at people who, like, are just like, I don't care. I'm more annoyed at those people. Don't at me. but, you know, listen, he can be crazy. I never thought of Kanye West as any kind of Messiah. So I think he's a very talented guy who made great music. And, you know, I think maybe needs a little bit more looking after than he's getting. But that's about it, you know.
So, I mean, but that's a real thing, right? Like, you know, we do place a lot of hopes on, you know, folks who work in culture to be able to lead politically, but that's not necessarily what their strengths are. You know?
Why are we looking to Kanye West for political commentary at all? Yeah, I think we sort of conflate these things.
It's really rare. I mean, somebody like a Harry Belafonte is like a once in a century type of person. You know, somebody like, you know, John Legend. You know, recognizes, like, his role is to be able to get messages out. Beyonce
and is good at as good at those two hats. You know what I mean? It's like, I guess I could organize a protest. It would be terrible. It would be very ill. Vishnu, my assistant, would be doing everything. the thing I can do is make a movie. You know what I mean? That's my lane. That's how I can really support and be a part of these other things, you know. But you're right. We do expect them to be everything, don't we?
We want them to be are all in all, I guess.
All right, talk to me about what you're doing right now, because I think it's really cool, because you're working with Kamau Bell.
We're doing a thing with Shannon Lee, Bruce Lee's daughter, and who runs the Bruce Lee Foundation and Bruce Lee Enterprises, and Kamau Bell and Sharon Lee, no relation, who also does a Bruce Lee podcast with Shannon. And the thing is, like, so So Kamau is a huge fan of Bruce Lee. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing a biography on Bruce Lee. And so I think Shannon and Sharon thought it was a really good idea to get all of us up on stage together and talk about these connections, these sort of Afro-Asian connections.
And I love Afro-Asian.
Yeah.
I love it. I love it. I love it so much.
I mean, there's a deep history to this, right?
There really, when you think about it,
yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a really deep history. And I think that, you know, a lot of folks rightly are focusing on anti-blackness. Mm-hmm. In Asian American communities and Asian communities, like
yeah.
the level of anti-blackness that you see happening in China, for instance, is just crazy.
It's egregious.
It's insane. It's horrible. You know, and these are just the things that we're seeing reported. But there's this deep history as well of these interchanges, these exchanges that happened. You know, somebody like Robin D.G. Kelly, who's a professor here at UCLA, has tracked, you know, the kinds of influences that went back and forth during the anti-colonial period, mm-hmm. and how that plays out, you know, in the U.S. and stuff. And I'm a product of, you know, generations of folks in the Bay Area who, generations of Asians and Pacific Islanders who have taken a lot of inspiration from the African-American struggle, mm-hmm. from the Black freedom struggle, from Black freedom culture. And there's like all these really cool kinds of things. But, you know, like Bruce's first U.S., you know, like student was a Black man, Jesse Glover, you know. And, you know, it goes all the way up to his deep friendship with Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Sure.
You know, and so, you know, there's a interesting thing that's kind of happening now where there's a lot of policing, especially I think on campuses, around questions of cultural appropriation. And in some ways, it's a necessary conversation that should have been had for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
But I think also the ways in which we talk about it, though, like are ahistorical. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't necessarily understand these deep linkages between communities.
It's not taught.
In LA, in San Francisco, you know, when Japanese Americans were incarcerated, you know, during the 1940s, during mm-hmm. World War II, mm-hmm. They live side by side with Black residents.
Absolutely.
You know, Bronzeville was right next to where Little Tokyo was. It was actually the same neighborhoods.
Right.
Right. And in many cases, African Americans were caretakers of the stores and the properties and the buildings and that kind of thing while Japanese Americans were incarcerated. And these kinds of histories are not told.
Yeah.
You know, the kinds of histories of sharing between, you know, students in Chinatown and the Black Panthers, for instance, you know, all of these different kinds of things are routinely kind of excised. And
yes.
So we have this kind of thing now where, you know, in like we use cultural appropriation to say that is my culture, mm-hmm. and yet we use the language of property, so it's my property.
Absolutely.
You can't touch my property.
And where did we learn that from?
We learned it from capitalism, and we learned it from whiteness.
That's right. Right.
And so it's not going far enough to be able to allow us to think about the exchanges that we need to build the imagination to figure out where to go next.
Well, I think it's awesome what you're doing, man. I think so many folks are caught up in being right and clapping back and not really seeing the things that we have in common. Do you have any don't at me's for us before I let you go? Like any controversial opinions, any things you want to say?
I mean, I don't know.
It could be anything. It could be random. It could be, I don't know. I hate Tootsie Pops.
You hate Tootsie Pops?
Tootsie Rolls.
Tootsie Rolls?
Why the hell would I want to lick through fruit-flavored candy for fake chocolate-flavored candy in the middle?
And it's not even like real chocolate.
It's not like, even real. Like,
it's not even caramel or anything. It's like,
why? Why did y'all ever?
It's got that waxy taste.
Introduce that nasty ass product into popular culture. And why are y'all eating these Tootsie Pops?
It's wrong.
That's my don't at me. What's yours, Jeff?
I don't know if I could really top that, man. I don't know if I can.
All right. Best hip-hop act 2018. Come on. Bring the don't at me.
Best hip-hop act in 2018. Man, this is so hard because it changes like every day.
That's right. It is hard.
You know?
Let's make some people angry.
It's actually been a good year, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's been a pretty good year for hip-hop.
Who's the one? Who's the winner?
That's hard.
Yeah, that's hard. Life's hard, Jeff.
I'll say this. I'm really excited about Earth Gang.
Mm.
I don't know why. There's something that's like kind of like, appeals to...
Who's Earth Gang?
So Earth Gang is this group from Atlanta.
Yep.
And to me, like, they can do everything. And they, for whatever reason, they only release, like, these short EPs, you know, of things. But they remind me of Outkast at their best, you know? And they just, they're dope. They're
all
really,
right,
really
y'all,
dope.
Don't add Jeff. It ain't Kendrick. It's Earth Gang.
Yo, Kendrick's dope, though.
He's dope.
Kendrick's dope. Kendrick's definitely dope.
I just want people to get upset with you, Jeff, so I can share the love.
All right, man. Definitely get upset at me. But you won't. You listen to Earth Gang, you won't be upset at me at all.
That's great. That's a great one. Well, I feel like if folks get into your books, man, they're going to find a whole bunch of things. So I'm just going to run it down for people. Can't Stop, Won't Stop, 2005. Who We Be, The Colorization of America. We Gonna Be All Right, Notes on Race and Resegregation, and you're writing a new book on Bruce Lee and Afro-Asianism. Where can people find you online?
How you can check out on Twitter, I'm at Zentronics.
Zentronics, break that Zentronics. Down. At Zen what now?
Zentronics, Zentronix.
Excellent. All right. So that's how we find Jeff, man. Thank you so much for being here, dude.
Thanks for having me, man.
We could do an 18-part. I say this every time. We got so much more stuff to talk about. But I really appreciate you being here, man. I've obviously, I'm a fan of yours. Your books mean a lot to me, and I'm so glad we were friends and we got to do this.
Likewise, man.
Thanks,
your work
dude.
Is so deep and so amazing, and it just moves me every time.
Checks in the mail. This was great, man. Thank you so much for doing
Goodbye,
this.
Goodbye, sir. Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, I'd like to thank my very special guest, Jeff Chang, producer Gina Delvag, head of programming Gary Scott, who just has fantastic hair, audio engineers Phil Richards and Ray Guarna, production assistants from Vishnu Vallabhaneni, music by Chris Bowers. I'm Justin Simeon. Please rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your app of choice. I love to name things the opposite of what I want you to do. I do want you to add me. You're free to at me at jsim07 on all the things. More next week from Don't At Me on the one and only KCRW.
Hey guys, it's Cheyenne Davis. You may know me from MTV's Teen Mom OG or Think Loud Crew podcast. I'm here with my dad, Papa Floyd, to tell you about our new podcast, Unfiltered Kitchen.
The kitchen is the hub of the household for many of us. The one-stop shop for conversations both big and small. Cheyenne and I have been having open conversations about all aspects of life in our kitchen since well before she was able to see over the counter.
And now we're inviting you into our own kitchen as a part of the family.
Unfiltered Kitchen is a two-way street. I share my advice on cocktails, cooking, parenting, and the lessons I've learned.
And I inform my dad what it's like to raise kids today, how generational barriers affect us, and the joys of being a daughter. Well, your daughter.
Get ready for a whole lot of unfiltered advice. You can take it or leave it, but you're never going to leave this table feeling hungry for more.
Listen to Unfiltered Kitchen wherever you get your podcasts.